Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kripko, and I'll be going over five recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on, but either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top five countdown for the week. At number five, we have Prime Minister Medvedev's visit to Bulgaria and the latest progress on bilateral relations. The Russian premier's visit was intended to explore the possibility of extending the TurkStream gas pipeline to the Balkan country and then onwards to Serbia and Central Europe, which is dependent on Sofia securing firm legal guarantees from Brussels in order to avoid a repeat of the South Stream fiasco that gave rise to the current project in the first place. The timing of his trip also coincided with his host Liberation Day celebrations, when Bulgaria remembers how it fought for freedom against the Ottoman Empire with Russian assistance, making this a very somber occasion and the perfect moment for any Russian leader to visit. Ties between the two Slavic countries have traditionally been close, though they've nevertheless had their fair share of problems as well, most notably during the two world wars when they found themselves on opposite sides. The complexity of Russian-Bulgarian relations explains why it's a lot easier said than done to propose TurkStream's extension to Bulgaria, especially given the recent context of the Balkan state becoming a joint US and EU protectorate and all but functioning as one of their vassals. That said, it speaks to the sincere desire of the Bulgarian authorities to advance their nation's interests that they're even trying to go forward with this possibility anyhow. The EU obviously needs the energy, and while they prefer to diversify more fully from their Russian supplier for political reasons or at the very least retain pipeline transit through Ukraine, they might be willing to accept TurkStream since they don't have any other realistic options available to them under the circumstances. Bulgaria's American ally, however, is clearly against this since it intends to sell more costly LNG to the continent instead. It can therefore be said that a struggle for influence is taking place in Bulgaria nowadays. The EU could leverage its economic and institutional weight in the country to promote TurkStream's extension to mainland Europe from Turkey, while the US could lean on its military influence through NATO and the national authorities under its sway to try to stop this from happening. Amidst all of this, there are evidently some Bulgarian decision makers who, despite their political faults and loyalty to one or another patron, nevertheless still care about their national interest and understand how important it is for their country that this Russian initiative succeeds. Hence why some headway has already been made in that direction thus far. It'll remain to be seen who comes out on top in the struggle for influence, but Bulgaria just became an important new Cold War battleground. The next one up is the political unrest in Algeria as its ailing leader seeks his fifth term next month. The North African state has been rocked by its largest protest since the 2011 Arab Spring after President Bouteflika, who was thought by many to be physically and possibly even mentally incapacitated after suffering a debilitating stroke in 2013, once again became the ruling party's candidate of choice for the upcoming elections. The elderly ruler helped bring peace to the country following its bloody civil war of the 1990s that many now regard in hindsight as being a proto-Syria after it pitted a secular government against Islamist insurgents, which is why Bouteflika is still so widely respected in society. Even so, the deteriorating standard of living that a growing number of people are experiencing has made it difficult for some to accept a continuation of the status quo. Bouteflika doesn't just represent a return to stability after around a decade of chaos, but he nowadays also stands for the military intelligence factions of the deep state that have kept Algeria safe since then, especially since he supposedly became unable to rule the country himself after a stroke. There's nothing wrong in principle with responsible members of a country's permanent bureaucracy steering the state behind the scenes in order to avoid troubled waters in a conflict-prone region, especially after a disastrous civil war. But the problem that some have with this is the resultant stagnation that has set in over the years. This is made even worse by the rumors that Bouteflika isn't really running the country, which is why some people feel so offended about his latest candidacy. Interestingly, one of the president's representatives read out a statement earlier this week promising that Bouteflika will step down after a year if he is elected and won't run in early elections that will take place afterwards, which is an extremely strange thing to say because it begs the question of why is even running in the upcoming election in the first place if that would really be the case. This might suggest something along the lines of what seems to be currently unfolding in Sudan, where long-running leader Omar al-Bashir appears to be gradually stepping aside in order to make way for his deep state to responsibly guide the inevitable transition that will eventually take place so as to avoid inadvertently destabilizing the fragile country during that tenuous time. On the one hand, it makes sense why Bouteflika, or the military intelligence members of the deep state that are thought to be the real power behind him, would decide to go with this approach, as he's rightly afraid that the Islamist ghost of the Civil War will return if Algeria undergoes a rapid regime change, despite it being a democratic and legitimate one. On the other hand, it's understandable why protesters who desire real change from the inside out might not trust that Bouteflika's promised early elections next year will lead to anything other than the deep state agreeing on someone to replace him. It's ultimately up to Algerians to judge what's best for their country, but it unquestionably appears as though Algeria is on the cusp of either cosmetic or fundamental change. Third in our countdown is the Democratic campaign for president after Hillary ruled out running. There was speculation ever since her epic loss last election that she'd throw her hat in the ring again one final time, but she put the rumors to rest in a recent TV interview when she ruled out running. She did say, however, that she'll work with the various candidates and continue speaking up for what she believes in, making it seem as though she's trying to play a so-called gray cardinal role over the process. In any case, while Clinton doesn't seem interested in going away anytime soon, it's better for the party as a whole that she decided not to run, because otherwise, her opponents would be pressured to sell out to her, submit, or get smashed if they refused to do so, which could have divided the party even more and brought about some terrible optics ahead of this do-or-die election for them. As it stands, the Democratic field is certainly crowded and full of diverse personalities representing the party's various factions, with the most prominent two being the leftist populist represented by Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, both of whom are usually regarded as socialists by the right wing, and the moderates led by Kamala Harris. There's also the superficially anti-systemic force being led by Tulsi Gabbard, but the mainstream media and the Democratic Party as a whole seem to be conspiring to suppress her campaign before it even gets off the ground. As such, it's most realistic to speak about the two aforementioned factions from here on out, with the leftist populace seemingly having the best chance to beat out the moderates if the party holds free and fair primary elections unlike last time. The reason for this prediction is because the political polarization that first became most noticeable under Bush led to the rise of Obama, which in turn fueled the reactionary rise of Trump. So there's a precedent of America nowadays going back and forth between the two left-wing and right-wing extremes. That doesn't necessarily mean that Trump will lose the next election, but just that the Democratic base might think that their best shot at winning is to proverbially fight fire with fire, which could explain why the president has preemptively targeted socialist ideas and made his crusade against them a staple of his re-election campaign. This naturally suggests that he might fear their electoral attractiveness and feel threatened by the prospects of going head-to-head with Bernie next year. It should nevertheless be kept in mind, however, that Hillary will undoubtedly try to throw her weight around both behind the scenes and in public, as she relishes in her envisioned gray cardinal role. This could be both helpful and harmful, depending on what she says to whom and how, and whether she conspires to undermine either of the two factions. Some might speculate that she'd lean towards supporting the moderates, but then again, if the base proves that they want the leftist populist, it wouldn't be inconceivable to see her one day out on the campaign trail stumping for Bernie, just like he did for her as part of his post-primary humiliation. That might be poetic justice, but it might also not be enough for the Democrats to beat Trump if some of them think that this means Bernie sold out. Our runner-up is Lavrov's tour of the GCC and Russia's growing relations with the Gulf monarchies. The Russian foreign minister traveled to Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and the United Arab Emirates in a chain of visits that showcased his country's improved ties with what are generally regarded as some of the U.S.'s closest allies. Russia's interests in these kingdoms are multifaceted, but mainly come down to energy coordination. bilateral investments, especially courting Gulf investments into Russia, diplomatic coordination on Syria, the arms trade, and the general desire to balance, the latter of which refers both to facilitating its partners' political diversification from the erstwhile dependence on the U.S. and to retaining excellent relations with both sides of the so-called GCC Cold War. Another point to focus on is Russia's interest in inter-regional integration as a catalyst for accelerating the emerging multipolar world order, which is relevant in this case if Lavrov's trip lays the basis for a future free trade agreement between the Eurasian Union and the GCC. While nothing of the sort is currently in the cards, it nevertheless remains an unstated long-term objective of the Russian state when considering how it's advanced this model in practically every other non-Western corner of Eurasia over the past few years. Prognosticating how this might one day play out in practice, Russia might eliminate any bureaucratic investment hurdles for its Gulf partners in exchange for them doing the same for the country's agricultural exports that are naturally in high demand in this part of the world. Altogether, Russia's rapid expansion of influence in the GCC confirms the success of Moscow's balancing strategy after it proved itself capable of incorporating this last corner of Eurasia into its supercontinental plans. This couldn't have happened had it not been for the peacemaking gains that were achieved over the past few years in Syria, as well as Russia's strategic partnership with Israel, which not so secretly enjoys excellent relations with the Gulf monarchies and possibly assisted this diplomatic opening behind the scenes. After all, Russia is very close with their mutual Iranian and Turkish enemies, so it makes sense for them to balance closer to Russia in response. At our top spot, we've got the U.S.'s plan to institutionalize its international coalition against Venezuela. National Security Advisor Bolton spoke about the need for a broad coalition that would help the U.S. create a completely democratic hemisphere, even going as far as proudly embracing the Monroe Doctrine by saying that the Trump administration is not afraid to use that phrase. He also provocatively recalled that the U.S. has been interested in this objective since the times of Reagan and the proxy wars that he supported in this part of the world to that supposed end. The U.S. already has the basis for its planned coalition through the so-called Lima Group, but taking it further by turning this collection of countries into a formal platform for carrying out regime change against Venezuela would amount to transforming it into a pan-hemispheric, NATO-like structure for policing Latin America, per the U.S.'s lead-from-behind stratagem aimed at creating Fortress America. To elaborate, the aforementioned concept refers to the U.S.'s grand strategy of regaining full and unchallenged hegemonic control over the Western Hemisphere after the chain reaction of constitutional and other types of coups that began in Honduras in 2009 under the Obama administration succeeded in rolling back the pink tide, culminating in the largest geostrategic prize thus far of Brazil after Bolsonaro's election. At this point, however, the U.S.'s covert subterfuge seems to have reached the limits of its success in the three remaining holdout countries of Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Cuba, which is why direct military intervention or the threat thereof against them, including through the support of armed proxies, might represent the next phase of Fortress America's implementation, bearing in mind that the other socialist country of Bolivia is much more easily manageable by dint of its landlocked location. The end game that the U.S. is aiming for is to remove all multipolar governments from the hemisphere as part of its new Cold War counterstrike against China and Russia, which would therefore give Washington full control over the hemisphere's resources and markets, while enabling it to leverage its hegemonic influence to deprive its rivals of the same, or at least strategically control their access to them. This is understandably an enormous undertaking, which is why the U.S. wants to have its vassals do the heavy lifting in order to also mask the revival of the Monroe Doctrine anticipating that the final outcome would then see them playing a role in creating a complementary U.S.-led economic structure to pair with the NATO-like one that it's in the process of assembling. Part of the genius behind the Fortress America concept is that it gives the U.S. the ultimate geostrategic redoubt upon which to rely in the event that its divide-and-rule machinations in the Eastern Hemisphere blow back against it and eventually result in diminishing the Pentagon's presence in the other half of the world. The conceivable, but nevertheless long-term, scenario of the Russian-Chinese strategic partnership somehow succeeding in the dismantlement of the U.S.'s numerous proxy structures in their part of the globe and replacing them with genuinely multipolar ones wouldn't necessarily lead to the U.S.'s collapse if it replaces its presence in those markets and dependence on those resources with a new one completely under its control in the Western Hemisphere. In fact, the U.S. wouldn't just survive, but might even thrive in that worst-case scenario. Okay, folks, so there you have it. This wraps up this week's edition of Context Countdown. And as I always do, I want to warmly thank each and every one of you for tuning into my program. Hope you all have a nice rest of your week and tune in again next week. Thank you. Bye.